That was a dirty trick. That old box up here, everybody else was standing on it. Kicked it under the podium when I got up here. My name's Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. And it's 9 o'clock in the morning, and we're all sick. I'm really grateful and delighted to be here, and I'm really delighted to be asked. And I wanted to thank Barbara. It was an interesting experience when I was asked here. They made me write a letter of intent that I was going to come, you know. And I was thinking, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me because, you know, if I'm not drinking, I'll be here. If I'm drinking, you can't believe anything I say anyway. So got it right back. And I always hesitate to sign things. The last time I signed something, I ended up in the Marine Corps. But I really am glad to be here. Nick picked me up at the airport and got me here safely, and I certainly appreciate that. And JC, I want to thank you for that warm introduction. I don't know. I don't know when I felt as welcome. Kind of hesitate to say much when you're sitting behind me. Last time somebody greeted me like that was my ex-wife's lawyer. I can't. It's good to see a lot of friends. I'm just delighted. Before I get started, I'd like to say a few things. Number one, if I use any objectionable language at all, I assure you it's because it crept from my filthy past, and if it happens, I apologize. It happens less and less often. I didn't get sober to continue to act like that. I hope it doesn't. But sometimes my mouth outruns my brain, and I really did sink into a cesspool as a result of my alcoholism, and because of you, I'm coming out of it, and I thank you very much. I'm also the baby of this whole group. I was looking at your speakers, and gee, you know, with the exception of me, you guys really, really went all out. I never heard Harriet before, and I was just delighted. It was a wonderful story. We have so much in common. I also went off to the Marine Corps like you did, honey. I wasn't fortunate enough to end up in the Navy. They kept me in the Marine Corps. And David and Gracie are just two of my most favorite people. And Tom B., who will be speaking tomorrow morning, is also from North Carolina. I've known Tom for a long time. And Sandy B. was one of my sponsors when I lived in Washington, D.C., so be thrilled to see Sandy when he gets here. And the other thing I'd like to say is I wore my gray trousers and my blue blazer, and everybody knows that's because, you know, I'm a graduate of Georgetown University, and now that the basketball season's over, I thought I'd wear my blue and gray, okay? It's not over, huh? No? No. What do I know? You know, I was... It's good to see friends from Cincinnati and Columbus and all over, and it's nice to see you all again. I was born in this part of the country. I was born in Ohio, small town on the Ohio River named Martin's Ferry, and nobody's there anymore. But I was born there, and I'm the second child in a family of 10 children. I'm Irish. I won't tell you what church we went to. I'll let you guess. But 40 hours over, you'll probably come up with it. You know, when I least expect it, I'll holler bingo or something, and you'll know. I purposely, when I was talking about the speakers, I purposely left Ken out. The thing that amazes me about Ken is we see one another around the country from time to time, and it always amazes me that he's still on the loose. It just intrigues me. I keep thinking, this guy's the luckiest man who ever lived. I mean, anybody else like that, they'd have thrown a net over him a long time ago and locked him away. You know? And I was in Dallas-Fort Worth Airport with him a few years ago, and we were going to Nebraska, and the flight was delayed, so he said, let's go eat. So we went over to get some, don't ever go anywhere with him, he'll embarrass you, but we went over to went over to get lunch, and we're standing in the lunch line. There were a whole line of people there, and they had a sign that said that there's a dietitian on duty. And Ken said, "I want to see the dietitian." You know, I thought, "Oh my God!" So I started trying to sneak away, and this lady came out, Mexican lady. Now she's about as much a dietitian as I am, and so Ken said to her, he said, "I had a question." He said, "I just ordered a cheeseburger and French fries." He said, "Is there a lot of cholesterol in this?" She said, "See, a lot of cholesterol." And he said, "Well, you know, I need a lot of cholesterol." He said, "If I don't get a lot of cholesterol by lunchtime every day," he said, "at night, the blood rushes through my heart and makes noise and keeps me awake." And she said, "See, more cholesterol." And then, Jesus. Not a well man at all, I'll tell you. I had something lived under my bed when I was a kid. I don't know if they have them in Indiana, but in Ohio, there's stuff that lives under your bed. And you know, if you're a skinny, scared little kid and you're laying in bed and you press your little ear against the mattress, you can hear it moving around down there. And I knew what it was there for. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the bed, and then I'm history. I knew that. I didn't, you know, didn't need a string of degrees to figure that one out. And it was only there at night. In the daytime, it wasn't there. In the daytime, it was in the closet. So I used to get my clothes out at night. And once I got in bed and it got dark, I never got out of bed. I laid there with full bladders and all sorts of things, but I never got out of bed. I knew better. And then, you know, what it would do is, if you look at your sheets in the morning, you'll see that there are lines that run right up to you. And what it does is it can reach up around the side of the bed for you. So I spent the better part of my youth lying in bed in the middle of the bed concentrating on being thin. And I also knew that if it ever got me, I'd never come back. And I knew that because I'd never met anybody who'd come back. And that made perfect sense to me. And the most important thing was I kept it a secret. I always kept all these things a secret. And I was driving to the airport yesterday. Funniest thing, you know how people are painting those little things on the panels of their car now, on the side of their cars, you know? Well, I'm driving to the airport, and there's a guy came sporting by me, and he had painted on there, "I'm different." And I was thinking, you know, I'm going to Indiana to meet about 1,000 people just like you. and you know, that's the way it was for me. I mean, I had to keep all this stuff a secret. All this stuff a secret. And I always like to talk about my first drinking experience. I had my first drink with my brother Denny. Old dumb Denny. And Denny's a year younger than I am. He looks much older, but he's a year younger. And the first time I drank, I was with my father and Dumb Denny. And we were hearing about Pennsylvania beer last night. Well, I was from the other end, and so ours was Iron City. And we were all at home. My mother was out. I don't know if she's having a baby or to bingo or something. And my father was watching us, and I was 5, and Denny was 4, and we were sitting around a kitchen table. And I guess my dad, it was really alcohol around, because both of my parents had a lot of alcoholism in their family, so there was rarely alcohol in our home when we grew up. And I guess my dad thought it might be funny, so he got a beer for each of us. And he gave us a bottle of beer, Iron City beer, and it was little glasses with jelly glasses, had cartoon characters on them. Some of you younger people will remember that. And my mine had Superman on it. I don't know if it's significant. A psychologist would probably think so, but we drank our beer, and it didn't do a thing to me. I mean, it really didn't. But I looked over, and old Denny sliding down out of the chair, and he was rolling around under the table, and he was singing "Mary Had a Little Lamb" and other drinking songs. And my father kind of panicked, and he wrestled Denny to the ground, and he took his clothes off, and he put his little jammies on, you know, the kind with the feet and the trap door and everything. And he said to me, he said, "Son, get ready for bed." And I said, "Okay, Dad." And I got ready for bed and went up and got in bed. And he brought old Den up. Den's laughing and carrying on. And he put him in the crib. And we shared a room with about 100 other people. And And I was laying there watching this, and Denny's giggling and laughing and everything, and my father said, "Don't tell your mother anything about this, and I'll take you to the movies." I thought, well, that's a good deal. So I was willing to play along, but Den wasn't hearing it. He's just having the best time. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. Old Den stood up and urinated on the floor. And I remember laying over there watching this kid thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And, you know, it's the saddest thing. Old Denny never made it. He just never made it. He grew up and he just got strange. He was just down recently playing golf. He comes down a few times a year to play golf. And it's just such a disappointment. He grew up and he went to one school. He had one major. And he graduated on time. Went to one graduate school, graduated on time, had about 8 job offers, looked them all over, picked one. Been working for this international corporation for a little over 20 years. He's a vice president, you know. And the strangest thing of all, he married one woman. Now you figure, here's a guy, when he was 4 years old, he had the world in the palm of his hand, and he just let it go, you know. I was 22 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor. I had to work at this thing. It's a sad case. I took an inventory, my very first inventory when I was 17 years old. I'd graduated from high school. Actually, I was run out of high school. I went to 12 years of parochial school. That's Catholic, for those of you who don't know. And principal came to me shortly before graduation, and he said, "You know, Mr. Lewis, it is not absolutely necessary you come to graduation. We will be glad to send you your diploma." And I said, "Well," I said, "my mother would be really disappointed if I didn't come." And he said, "You know, we'd be really disappointed if you do." I was, if we had money and that sort of thing, which we didn't, I would have been an acting out adolescent. The truth was, I was a punk because we were poor. And just in trouble an awful lot. I'm sure there are good reasons for it, mainly because I was a punk. That's the main reason. So I went to the graduation, and things always seemed to happen to me. I was the shortest guy in the class, so I had to go first. Remember that? They line you up by size to ridicule you, you know? And you ever see that? You know, the boys would be walking past the girls, and they wouldn't even look till half the line was gone. And so they had to go on these bleachers, you know, and so I'm clear at the end, right? And they start moving over a fraction of an inch at a time, you know? And about the time the bishop was sharing some sort of spiritual message with us and the parents, I ran out of bleacher. And he turned around and looked, and I was hanging on the backdrop of the stage. And they helped me down, and I looked over, and the principal was crying. He had his head in his hands, and he was crying. Then we had to go up and get our diplomas from the bishop. And, you know, you had to get down on one knee and had these gowns on. I'm not used to wearing dresses, no matter what they said. And you kiss the bishop's ring, and it's a sign of respect, and you get your diploma, and then you stand up. Well, as some of you ladies may know, if you kneel down and you put your foot on your dress and you stand up, you tend to go forward. And I fell in the bishop's lap. Been a bishop a long time. I was the first person to ever fall in his lap. And I felt bad about it. And I turned around, and my principal was crying. He had his head in his hands, and he was crying. And he never spoke to me again. And I think that damaged me a lot. And I went home, and a few days later, I took an inventory. I took my shirt off. I stood in front of the mirror, and I flexed my muscles and everything. And I was 5 feet 1 inches tall, and I weighed 113 pounds. I was a born killer. And so I went and joined the Marine Corps. It seemed like the only thing to do. Seemed like the only organization that could contain me. And I never forget that night. My mother cried all night. She was crying and everything. She was saying, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my dad says, "Don't worry, Pat, they'll send him home." And I got on a bus the next morning and went to Pittsburgh. Now, Pittsburgh was 60 miles away, and it's the second longest trip I ever took in my life. Once I went to Cleveland, but the game was rained out. And so here I am on a bus. I'm in Cleveland and Pittsburgh. And I had one of these ideas about the world that everybody knew what was going on but me. You ever think like that? Everybody understood the big picture, and I was the only one who didn't understand it. I sort of thought that, like, God got everybody in a room like this, and he just explained everything to everybody, you know? He told the boys about the girls and the girls about the boys, and for the people from California, he told the boys about the boys and the girls about the girls. And then he explained to everybody about... he explained about what it was like to grow up, and he explained to everybody about the Marine Corps and all that stuff. You know, the only thing I knew about the Marine Corps was that they took people down South Carolina and periodically drowned some of them. He explained everything, and I was in the bathroom, and I was the only one who didn't understand what was going on in the world. And so my job was to act like I knew, and I'd watch you very, very closely, and when you did something, I'd do it too. And I'd look confident and act like I knew. And because I thought you knew. You know, it wasn't until I got to AA I found out you didn't know what was going on either, that none of us do. And that's the fun of it. I mean, that's the fun of life. Nobody knows what's going on. Everybody acts like they know, but nobody does. And that's what makes it great. And so I went up there, and it was a very bad year, so they took me. And there were four of us who joined at the same time. And three of them were from Pittsburgh and me. And they were in the know. I mean, these guys knew what was going on. And we finished at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and the train didn't leave until midnight. So the one guy said, he said, "We're going to go over and have a sandwich and a few beers. Would you like to join us?" I said, "Well, what do I know? I'm from out of town." So I went along, and I went into a bar in Pittsburgh, and it was filled with real men. You know, the kind, you know, they got tattoos, they spit on the floor. And all of them have a real woman with them. Real women are women who hang around with real men. And guys like me get what's left. And so we went over and we sat down, and a bartender came over. He's a real man. He said, "What do you want?" And I thought, oh, my God, a quiz. I always had this feeling that when you least expected it, somebody was going to say, "Take out a blank sheet of paper. Put your name in the upper left-hand corner." And I hadn't studied the night before. And that's just the way I felt about life. So I didn't know what to say. So I looked at the other guys, and they all ordered a beer, so I did too. And he came back and asked the same question, gave him the same answer. Well, the third time, I catch on, you know. So the third time, I answered first. And then it happened. And if you are alcoholic, you know precisely what I mean when I say it happened. I was vaulted into a new dimension. My life changed dramatically. And it was somewhere between the second and the third drink that my life was different. It was altered in a way that would never, ever be undone. And I remember I stood up. I didn't mean to stand up. I just stood up. I don't think I could have kept from standing up, you know. And I looked down, and the floor was 6 feet 4 inches below me. And I looked out, and my right shoulder was out to here, and my left shoulder was out to there, and the muscles were rippling through my body and pulling at my shirt, you know. And that mind that had been filled with fear and terror and doubt and all that stuff, all of a sudden, boom, was clear, crystal clear. And I remember thinking, of course, it's so simple. Why didn't I see it before? You know, and I looked up, and I looked around this room, and my heart broke. The room was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snivelling little men, you know. And all of them had women with them, or looking at me with the hungry eyes. You know how they do it. And I stumbled, you know. And a guy said, "What's the matter?" I said, "I don't know. I think I just tripped over an invisible line." And I, like Harriet, I believe I was born to the cloth. I really believe I was born an alcoholic. And that, it took me 3 beers to cross that line. Now, Now, I really feel this now. I drank for another 12 years. Now, I didn't get... I got a lot sicker. I got an awful lot sicker than that. But I don't believe I ever got any more alcoholic. I believe that's about as alcoholic as I ever got. Because that's when my life dramatically changed. Every aspect of my life changed between a second and a third drink. It was the most magnificent experience I'd ever had up until the time that I'd been with you for a while. Most magnificent experience. And I really believe that that means that, that I was alcoholism waiting for a drink. And it took the second and third drink to do that for me. And I spent the next 12 years trying to find that. And I never ever got back there. I remember that night. I walked around that room. I went from table to table. People had so many questions. They didn't understand anything. And I was filling them in on life. I explained to them about life, about the Marine Corps, about women, about men. I just knew it all. It was amazing. And I was there for hours, and they just kept draining me and buying me beer and getting more from me. And it came time to leave. I imagined that they said something like, they stood up and they said, "Please don't go. You know, we've just found you." And I said, "Well, I have to go and defend our country." And I left and I went and got on the train I woke up the next morning. Now, back then, the Marine Corps, you traveled well. You traveled by Pullman coach. And it was nice, you know, and I didn't know what a Pullman coach was, but they gave me one. And the next morning I woke up on the floor of the Pullman coach, and they're pounding on my door, and someone had wet the floor I was lying on. I have no idea who did that, but whoever did it wet me too. And I got up and quickly showered and changed clothes, I was in Washington, D.C. I was three times as far from home as I'd ever been in my life, and I was terrified. I was small and frightened and didn't know anything again. And the guys I was with said, "Look, we're going to go over to the Monaco and have a few drinks. Do you want to join us?" And I thought, "Well, what do I know? I'm from out of town." And the same thing happened. And that evening, I fell off a train in Yamasee, South Carolina. Someone moved the bottom step, and I fell across the railroad tracks. And they had a very, very rude man who met us there. Called him a drone instructor. And... he was hurling obscenities at myself and the other men who had gone down there to die for their country. And I got up and I tried to explain to this cretin that he'd get a lot further if he treated us with a little bit of respect. And I was not very convincing. They say that you learn from every experience. And I must tell you, the only thing I learned from that experience was I could do a lot of push-ups drunk. A lot of push-ups drunk. And you could do push-ups, turn your head, get sick, and keep doing push-ups. I learned that. And then I went and I was a member of the United States Marine Corps. And I must say I loved it. I really did. I always said next to the nuns it was easy. I just took to it like a duck to water. It was the greatest thing ever happened to me. They always said, "Does it bother you to sleep in a barracks?" Well, there were fewer people in that barracks than were my home. I felt alone in a barracks and I won Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award. And I really loved the Marine Corps. And I was going to stay for 100 years. The problem was that I was alcoholic. You see, I'd crossed that line. And I didn't drink for a while. But when I did, you know what happened. I remember we were stationed at Camp Lejeune, my first duty station. And a guy said to me, he said, "Look, I'm going to go over to the club and get a cheeseburger. You want to come?" So we went over and had a cheeseburger and a couple of beers. And the next day, I said to him, "Look, you want to go over and get a cheeseburger?" He said, "No, I have to stay here and square my gear away." So I went alone. That's it. That's alcoholism. And people often ask me, "What's your definition of alcoholism?" And it's very, very simple. If alcohol means more to you than anything else, you're an alcoholic. It's just that simple. And, you know, and pretty soon it meant more to me than everything else, every dream I ever had. And we talk about paying the price for our alcoholism. You know, there was never a price that was too great, ever. I paid whatever it cost. People always talk about raising tax on booze and maybe alcoholics won't drink. It's nonsense. It's utter nonsense. It tells me I don't know anything about alcoholics. I paid whatever price there was. You know, one day I went into the NCO club and I had worked very, very hard and I had received a opportunity to go to officer's candidate school in Quantico, Virginia. And I'd worked very, very hard for that. I walked into a club one day and they said, I said, "Give me a scotch on the rocks." And I said to the bartender, how much is that? He said, well, that'll be 30 cents in your Marine Corps career. And I said, well, it seems right to me. Well, I paid it. You know, and sure enough, it was my Marine Corps career. And I got out. And I got out and I blamed the Marine Corps and I did all that stuff. But it wasn't any of that. And then one day I was directing genetics units at Georgetown University Hospital, and I walked in and asked for a bottle of rum, and I said, what would it cost? And they said, well, it's simple. It'll, you know, cost you $5.50 and your wife and two daughters. And I thought, well, that isn't too much to pay, because I got to have that. And I paid it. And then one day I was living in a dive in Skid Row in Washington, D.C., and I went up to get a bottle of wine, and I was shaking, and I was sick. And I said, what would it cost? And the guy said, it was 69 cents in your life. And I thought, well, that sounds about right, and I paid it. And I went home, and I ended up that day trying to commit suicide, or the next morning. And it never, ever struck me as being too much, because that's what it was called for. And I know now that alcoholism is that disease that demands the last farthing, demands absolutely everything we had, and I paid everything that I had. And when I woke up that morning, and I always thought that alcoholism would be or suicide would be a big deal, and it's really not. I've seen a lot of people in this program or try to get this program kill themselves. I met a man just about 2 months ago in North Carolina, a man I love very much, and a truly, truly lovely man. Blow his brains out. He'd been sober about 22 years, and like Harriet said, he got on the tablets, and within about 2 years, he blew his brains out. And here's a sweet man who helped a lot of people and cared an awful lot about people. So we're not strangers to suicide. Suicide's the outcome of what we do and what we have. The miracle to me is that there's 1,000 of us here who may not have to do it. That's a miracle to me. I'm never surprised when people kill themselves. I'm surprised that some of us, by the grace of God, don't have to. And I'll miss him. But, you know, if you're going to run with the drunks, that's what happens. And the great miracle is that I know that's where I'd be if it weren't for you. And so I'm never surprised about that. And I went into a bathroom where I was living, or what passed for a bathroom. And I worked in hospitals, and my ex-wife had worked in hospitals, and pills were very, very available then, and a lot of them you didn't need prescriptions for that you need prescriptions for now, and we had hundreds of them, and I never took pills. I was always afraid of them. Somebody told me once, that's the saddest story they ever heard, but I was always afraid of them, but I kept them, and I had hundreds, and I had enough to kill me and half of Northwest Washington, and I went in, and I began to take them or didn't. I don't know to this day. I put them all in a glass, and I really can't tell you if I began to take them or not. But what I do remember is I heard a voice. And it's a very interesting thing, and I won't go into it now, but I have a really strong sensation of why what happened to me happened to me. But I heard this voice. It was a woman's voice. And I said, at least it'll be, I'm 29, at least it'll be over. And this voice said, when you're 29, it's not supposed to be over, it's supposed to be starting. And it startled me. And if you've been in a fog and you've been where I was, and many of you have been, you hear something crystal clear, startling. And it startled me. And I remembered that this woman who I'd tormented for those years had given me 2 phone numbers when she asked me to leave. And I ran and looked for those phone numbers, and I could only find one. One of them was to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't find it. It was the intergroup number in Washington, D.C. I didn't know that's what it was to. I didn't know what these numbers were to. But I found one of the numbers and I called it. And I happened to call one of the 2 little treatment centers in that area where they treat me for what I had, which was alcoholism, and not for being suicidal and all the rest of it that I was. And it seems to be very popular to stand up here and to slam treatment centers and things. But I got to tell you, if it weren't for this place, you'd have somebody else up here this morning. And that's just the way I feel. And if that offends you, I'm sorry, I don't mean to. But I called this, and a woman with a British accent named Dorothy answered the phone. And I never forget it as long as I live. I just said, it blurted out. I said, if you can't help me, I think I'm going to die. And I think she heard the panic in my voice, and And she said, "Would you please give me your phone number, son, and I'll call you right back." And I know now that she wanted to get my phone number in case they needed to call the police to find me. And I gave her my phone number, and I hung the phone up, and I sat down on the floor, and I began to sob. And I can't remember the last time I cried. My baby daughter almost died when she was born, and I sat in an office across from her, and I watched her mother walk up and down the floor like a zombie. And I watched her go in and baptize this little pound and a half infant because I didn't think she'd live through the night. And I wanted to cry, and I couldn't. I wanted to run in and put my arms around both of them and say, "You know, I'm here for you, and we'll do this together." But I couldn't, because by this time my alcoholism had me so isolated that I didn't feel attached to anything. In the grace of God, that little girl lived, and is a senior at Auburn University and an honor student, and soon to go to London. And I cried, and the phone rang, and a woman talked to me for a little while, and she said to me, "It sounds like you're an alcoholic." And I said, "Well, I don't think I'm an alcoholic." I said, I don't know what's the matter." And she told me where they were, and it was about 30 miles away. And she said, we can't take you for 3 days. Will you be all right?" I said, "Well, I guess I will be." And she said, "Please try not to drink. And if you need to, get to a hospital." Well, I worked in a hospital, and I knew as an alcoholic, I couldn't go to a hospital. Like Harriet said, we used 12-step people in Washington, D.C., and sometimes they'd be really, really sick, and we knew they were going into DTs, and all we could do is get them drunk and take them down to the White House and tell them to go tell the guard you want to see the president. Because if you show up at the White House under the influence and you want to see the president, they put you in the nut house to observe you. And that's how we used to get some alcoholics help. And so I knew as an alcoholic I couldn't go to this prestigious teaching hospital. And so I just waited, and I had to get some money, and I was running around trying to get some money, and I was auditory hallucinations. I was hearing Beethoven's Fifth. For 3 days I heard Beethoven's Fifth. And I was sitting in a bank trying to talk to this guy, and to give me a loan on his car that wasn't worth anything, and I'm tapping my foot to Beethoven's Fifth, and it suddenly occurred to me that the bank did not have Muzak, and I was the only one enjoying the London Philharmonic Symphony that particular morning. And I started seeing those little things that dart around the corners and things like that. And somehow, and I must have convulsed. Of course, you don't remember that. But somehow, I the right day, I got up and I got dressed and I took a shower and I shaved. And I got in this car and I began to drive 30 miles to this treatment center. And it wasn't a difficult drive. Later, I was to make it many, many times. But for me, it was the most excruciating trip I ever took in my life. I could only go about a mile, and the horrors would settle in. And if you don't know what the horrors are, you don't want them. And I would begin to shake, and I'd begin to cry, and I'd get the car off the side of the road, and I'd get out, and I'd be physically sick, and I'd sob, and sometimes I'd lay down in the grass because it was cool. And I wet my pants, and I'm trying to change my pants on Route 29 outside of Washington, D.C., and my Phi Theta Kappa key fell out. And it struck me as strange, this disease of alcoholism. And somehow I got out there, and I was 5 hours late because it took me 5 hours to drive that. And somebody else had gotten in my bed, and I said to the lady, "Can I stay in your parking lot, keep my car in your parking lot?" And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, because if I go back to D.C., I'm going to die." And she said, "You can sleep on a sofa." And that night somebody ran away, and I got their bed. I hope they're okay, but I needed their bed. And that night, another thing happened to me. They took me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was the youngest person in the treatment center, and they took me, except for one guy, my roommate was younger, and they took me off to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and on the way out there, I was scared, and I was still shaky, and I said, "What is this, Alcoholics Anonymous? I'd never heard of you." And they said, "Well, it's an organization." He said, "People get together in the basement of churches, and they talk about not drinking." And I thought, "Good Lord, what's that?" And I got there, and they had a greeter. And like Ken was talking about last night, they had a greeter. And I get to be the greeter in my group. I love that. That's one of my favorite things, man. But the greeter was there. It was an old man. Everybody in AA was old then. The guy was a freak. He had two heads, because every place I looked, he was looking me in the eye. You know? You ever run into people like that? I people, you know? I was a shoe person. And then the first person I meet in AA is an I person. And every time I turned my head, one of his heads was right there, and he looking me in the eye, and he's shaking my hand. And I don't mean, I like hugging, believe me. I think hugging's a nice thing. But there used to be a lot more handshaking going on. And I like handshaking, because when you shake someone's hand, the firmness of that handshake, and you look one another in the eye, and I like that. I really do. But he said to me, he said, you know, son, you keep coming here, you may never have to drink again. And I thought, isn't that a strange thing to say? And then he took me over and he introduced me to this old woman, about 10 days older than dirt. And he sat me down beside her, and she got me a half a cup of coffee, and she began to talk to me. And through the whole meeting, she was just patting me. I'm thinking, oh, my God, here I am. You know, I'm 29 years old, and I'm in a room with a bunch of perverts. And halfway through the meeting, she looked at me, and that old face exploded into a beautiful smile. And she said, you know, son, if you keep coming here, you'll never have to be alone again. And I started to cry. Honest to God, I didn't know that what I was alone. I really didn't know that. I didn't know I was alone until that very, very moment. And it explained so much to me. It explained to me why I could walk away from things and never look back. Why I didn't have to be in touch with my family, and I didn't have to care much about what happened to my brothers and sisters. It explained to me why I even when I was in a job that I enjoyed, I was always looking for another one. Or if I was in a relationship I enjoyed, I was always looking for another one. It explained to me why I no longer felt close to that God I was raised with. One of those people, you see a lot of them around, I always said things like, I don't like organized religion. Well, the truth was, I wasn't a pope. If I'd have been a pope, I would have loved organized religion. Yeah? The whole deal was, I wasn't in charge. But being alone explained so much to me, so very, very much to me. And as a person who was so very, very alone, the perfect place for me was you, to be with you. And early on, I wanted you. I for a long time, I didn't believe that I could be like you. And I didn't believe that you would have me here long. I really didn't. I couldn't tell the truth very well. I'd always mean to. The truth was in my brain, but it wouldn't come out my mouth. It would be there, and I'd say, I'm going to answer this one the right way. And I'd open my mouth, and something else would come out. And you always knew. You'd just smile and say, keep coming back. And you know, I had done some despicable things, absolutely despicable things, things about which I had tremendous amounts of guilt. I don't anymore because this program works perfectly. I can't refill any of those things anymore. That's how well this program works. I can remember them, of course, but I can't refill them because those steps work. And a gentleman, Brett, who read the 12 steps, you know, you think, read them, sorry, you ought to work them. I mean, that's hard. I know you have, but I mean, it's hard, you know. But it's the only way for a person like me to ever feel different than I did when I came in here. It's the only way. There's no other way other than these 12 steps. And I just started going to meetings, and I just went to a lot of meetings. A lot of meetings, and I got a sponsor. And like I say, you know, I've had three sponsors, but my first sponsor, Dan, was absolutely perfect for me. That guy loved me in ways that was just incredible to me. And I picked him because he was calm. My insides were always a wreck. And I picked him because he was calm. And my second sponsor, you'll hear tonight, Sandy B., who taught me about working the steps and taught me about speaking and taught me about being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my third sponsor is Tom I., who I love. Gee. We celebrated Tom's 35th birthday in February, and we brought his sponsor, Cecil, from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada. And Cecil brought his sponsor. And it was Tom, and it was me, and it was David, and it was Harvey, and it was Roy. And then I looked at it, there were about 400 people there, and probably 300 of them had somehow been involved with Tom. And that struck me, and it overwhelmed me how lucky I am to be involved in a network like that. And if you're kind of new and you don't have a sponsor, please get one. Don't get one because they're cool, and don't get one because they're witty or they're cute. Get one who lives the principles of this program. Get one who you want to be like when you grow up. And if you'll do that, you'll reap the rewards of this thing. But I've had the best sponsorship in the world. And they taught me things like principles. You know, what we reap, we really do so. They taught me that there are certain principles. And if I do certain things, I'll get certain results. If I do other things, I'll get other results. I can't do what I want to do and ever expect to be happy. I remember saying to Sandy one time, you know, that age-old question. I don't know God's will for me. And he took one look at me and he smiled and he said, Keith, in your case, God's will is not your will. I said, it's not fair. He said, I know it isn't, but that's the way it is. He said, so do what is not your will and you'll be a lot closer. Also, Sandy, when I asked Sandy to be my sponsor, I was sober about a little over three years, and I've been sponsoring myself for about a year, which meant I had an idiot for a sponsor, and I was an absolute wreck, just a complete and utter wreck. And I went to Sandy, and I was sucking on about four packs of cigarettes a day and everything, and just a madman. I went to Sandy, and I said, I'd like to talk to you. He said, great. He said, bring your running shoes. I said, I don't have any running shoes. He said, get some running shoes and bring them. So I went out and bought a pair of running shoes, and I show up with two extra packs of cigarettes because I knew this was going to be a heavy problem. I had no idea why we had running shoes. And he said, put on your shoes. And I put on my shoes. And he said, where are we going? He said, we're going running. I said, I can't run. I smoke four packs of cigarettes a day. He said, this will help you get to the point. And didn't take long. I got right to the point. And and I said to him, I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, the strangest thing. Sponsors never answer questions. You know, they never say yes or no. They don't know the words yes or no. You know? I said, will you be my sponsor? And he turned to me and he said, do you believe in God? I thought, that's a strange way to answer a question. But I thought about it. I know it must be important because you talked a lot about him. And so I thought about it. And I had an old idea. I mean, I had hundreds of old ideas. But one of them was this one. If you doubt about God at all, if there's any doubt at all, it means you don't believe. I mean, that's what I thought. Now, it wasn't until later I found out that element of faith is doubt. I mean, doubt's proof there's faith. But I didn't know that. So I thought about it, and I want to be perfectly honest with this guy. And my head said to me, tell him yes. And I opened my mouth, and I said no. And inadvertently, I told the truth. And he looked at me, he was real sad, and he said, well, that's too bad. That means you're probably going to die. And I stopped. And I thought for a minute, and I caught up with him. I said, you know, I'm willing to go home and reconsider my opinion. He said, you know, if you reconsider your opinion, I'll sponsor you. And he did. And I've come to realize that I was wrong. You know, it's a funny thing. When I first used to come around to meetings, there are old-timers around, and I'd stay away from them. They're sick lot, old timers. I don't know if I can say this because of all the speakers, the only two that aren't old timers is me and the Alatine speaker, and I'm not too sure about him. I can't wait to hear him. I understand he gives a great lead. But I can say this because I'm not one of them. But old timers are not well people. They really aren't. And, you know, they say stuff that just isn't true. They say things like, well, we keep coming here because we need to. That's not true. They don't need to come here. The only reason they come here is the only enjoyment they get out of life anymore is watching people like you and me suffer. That's the truth. If you don't believe me, pick one of them out. You know, there are a bunch of them around. Pick one out and tell them a problem. First thing they do is laugh. You know? I had a minor problem as impotent, which you really put a crimp in your sex life. And I went to an old timer and I told him, I said, I'm impotent. They love that one. They love it if you can't have sex, because they don't have sex anymore either. No? He said, it'll be all right. He said, it'll go away. I said, when? He said, what are you know? You got a full social calendar? You know. So be careful of them, you know. Be real careful. And this one old-timer pulled me aside. I belong to the Problem of the Month group. You know anything like that? You know? We'd sit around and figure out the worst problem. And I go, oh. And I had an old idea that went something like this. If I don't find the answer to this problem, I got to drink. I got so much time, the clock's ticking. And if I don't come up with the answer to this problem, there's only one answer to this problem, I got to drink. So I thought, oh my God. So I go run into this old-timer, right? And he said, look. He said, I want you to borrow lipstick from one of the girls. He said, I don't want you to know anything else from any of the girls. And he said, oh, that's right, you can't. He said, I want you to borrow lipstick from one of the girls, and I want you to go home, and I want you to write on your mirror, Keith, you are wrong. I said, well, I can't do that. You see, my problem is I have a poor self-image, and I need to be affirmed. Don't ever say anything like that to an old-timer. They have not read any of those books. So he said, just go borrow some. So I went and bought a tube of lipstick. I didn't want to owe anything to anybody, especially a woman. So I went and bought a tube of lipstick, and I went home and I wrote on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I knew you were all crazy, and I was just disgusted. And I threw the tube of lipstick away, and I went and I got ready, and I got in bed. And it was a normal night. Remember a normal night at 90 days? Oh. You know, I lay down, and my mind just wakes up. You know? And it's in the inquiry mood. You know when your mind's in the inquiry mood? Hey, how about your ex-wife? How about the kids? How about the thousands of dollars in debt? How about your sex life? Yeah, you're never going to, you know. How about your job? Yeah, tell me, how about that? Oh, yeah, how about your family? I haven't talked to your family in 100 years. Yeah. What if they're still alive? They're probably half of them are probably dead. You don't care. You know, it's in the inquiry mode. And I'd lay there, normal night. And, you know, I'd drift off to sleep and my legs would cramp up. You know, sort of like my legs were saying, hey, we got more questions. You know? And I got up the next morning and, you know, and I didn't really go to sleep till it was time to get up. And then I was dead asleep, you know. And then I opened my eyes and depression was waiting at the bottom of the bed. It'd jump on me, you know. And I get up in the morning, you know, and I'd feel like I was 100 years old and I'd go out in the kitchen and I need to start again. Well, today you're going to go to work. And they're going to find out you don't know how to do your job. What difference does it make? You're going to be alone the rest of your life. And I'd start making the coffee, and I'd want to cry. And I'd be so depressed, I'd want to cry. And you know, you'll never get this God thing. And I went in the bathroom, I looked on the mirror, and it said, Keith, you're wrong. I said, well, thank God, because if I'm right, I'm in a lot of trouble. So the great gift that we have here is that we're wrong. We're wrong about everything. And that's the fun of it all. Being wrong is what's fun. You know, I was wrong about everything. You know, I'd have told you that I could never be in a decent marriage. You know, I was wrong. I could be. I just didn't know how to do it. It's one of the many, many, many things I didn't know how to do. You know, when Dan was my sponsor, I was sober 6 months, and I ended up studying in Paris. It was a strange thing. I spoke to one angry person who was sober 30 years, thank you. And I said, geez, I said, you know, I'm sober about 4 months. And I said, I've been asked to come to Paris to study with probably the greatest cytologist in the world. I said, I don't know what to do. And he said, you're not ready. You can't do everything else. And I said, well, maybe I'll go talk to my sponsor. And I went and talked to Dan, and Dan said, isn't that wonderful? He said, you know, we can get ready for you to go to France sober. And we got ready. We talked to people who'd been over there. I knew where the meeting was. I had Charlie B's name. And we got me ready to go there and study. And I got off that plane New Year's Day, 1974, New Year's Eve. And I made myself stay awake till midnight. And I had laying in bed, I had a little bottle of Perrier water. And at midnight, I toasted you guys, and I went to sleep. And I woke up about 4 hours later, and I was walking the streets of Paris, and the sun was coming up, and I was free. And I didn't need to drink, and I didn't want to drink. And I found you over there, and you spoke languages I didn't understand. But hell, I drank in bars where they spoke languages I didn't understand. And I just hung around with you, and I studied there, and Dan, just my sponsor, just happened to be coming through Paris. One of those freak things that And I never forget, I was talking to somebody I know who's going over there, and I told him this story. I said, you know, we got on a plane, or a train, and we drove this train down to Chartres. And you know, one of the things I never told anybody was I was terribly afraid of heights. And when I was in the Marine Corps, the way I dealt with that was I volunteered to go to jump school. And they wouldn't let me go because I'd busted up a kidney, so I went and climbed mountains. I went to mountain climbing school in the winter in California, Sierra Nevadas. And I always thought that being afraid, what you're supposed to do is be brave. And so I went and I tried to be brave, and I climbed mountains, and I was the only guy who did it drunk with his eyes closed. I came back from California more afraid of height than I was when I went. Because I thought the solution to fear was being brave. And it isn't. And we're down there, and we get off the train, and we're walking across this beautiful little square in Sartre, France, and to see the cathedral. And Dan said to me, he said, there's a catwalk that goes right around the top of it. And he said, we can walk out on that, and we can look down on the church, and my heart just froze. And I said, I got to be brave again. And then I said, no, I don't. I said, Dan, I'm afraid of height. And he said, oh, you got the old I'm afraid of height problem. He said, a lot of us have had that. He said, you don't need to go up on that catwalk. He said, if you like, we can just go part way up the steps, and you can probably see the same thing. And that's what we did. And we got halfway up the steps, and he took my hand, and we walked the rest of the way up. And I didn't go leaning over the rail or anything. But I was up there. And that's what it's been for the almost 19 years that I've been with you. Whenever I get afraid, and I feel like I need to be brave and do it myself, I just put out my hand, and you're there, and you take me by the hand, and one day we're over it. And I don't know why that works. I don't understand why it works. I just know that it does work. And so, you see, I've been wrong about everything. I've been wrong about absolutely everything. I was wrong about Dumb Denny. You know, Dumb Denny, I couldn't stand Denny. I mean, Denny was your worst nightmare if you're an alcoholic. I mean, here's a guy who does everything right, you know. And I sober a little while, and because of Sandy, I was very involved in working these steps. And Denny was living in New Jersey at that time. He's back there, and he was on my list. And I decided I needed to go make amends to Denny, because Denny was good and I was bad, and Denny was successful and I was unsuccessful, and Denny was to be admired and I was to be loathed. And I went up to see him, and his wife Jan knew that this must be important, and we hadn't talked much. And his wife Jan knew that this must be important, and she excused herself and went to bed. And I told him, I said, you know, I've come here to make amends to you because of the things I've said about you. I said, whenever your name came up in the family, I always said whatever I could that was negative, because I admire you so much, and you look so good to me. And he started laughing, and he said, if you owe me an amends, then I owe you an amends. He said, I've always admired you. He said, you went and did things that I just thought about doing. He said, you see, I've always been afraid. I was afraid to change my major, and I was afraid to change schools. He said, and you've seen my wife, I'm afraid to leave her. And he said, I always watched you, you know. And he said, you never seemed to give a shit about anything. So if you didn't like it in one country, you went to another country. He said, nothing ever seemed to stop you. And he said, I knew if things ever got bad in my life, I'd be stopped. And he said, nothing would ever stop you. And I found out I was wrong. We aren't better or worse. We're just different. And we get together and we play golf, and he's one of my very best friends. And last year we went up and we took second place in his club championship. And I was honestly able to look at him and say, if it weren't for you, we'd have taken first place. No, I didn't. No, I didn't say that. But it's the key to this whole deal is being wrong. Please, if you're new, please find yourself a sponsor. Don't get involved in controversy. It's not worth it. It doesn't matter. It really isn't important. Honestly, it isn't. You know, when you stand at the grave of enough friends in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, you begin to realize what's important. My daughter Kelly came to visit me. She's my oldest daughter. She stopped down to visit me, and I saw this beautiful 23-year-old woman who's really doing well. And I started to think, you know, there was a time when I thought that if I couldn't raise her, I'd die. That it was important that she know how much I loved her. And it's not important. What's important is that she's okay. It was really important one time that I determined who God was. It's not important. All that's important is that God is. I was one of those people, like the big book says, who returned to the church of his childhood. I love it. I got here early enough yesterday, and I went over to Mass at the cathedral across the street. And I loved it. And I went to the Sacrament of Reconciliation because you taught me how to inventory and how to share that with God and another human being. I just want to belong. I have a priest who's younger than me. Went to Duke University, so you wouldn't like him either. And he tells me things to do, and I do them. I don't do them because I agree with them, and I don't do them because they make sense. Because nothing you ever told me to do I agreed with, and nothing you ever told me to do makes sense. Until I did it. See, I used to believe that if I heard I had to drink, or if I heard it was important, it's not important. I sponsor the most beautiful guys in the world, and one of them, I called home last night, and he had called. And he'll call me up, and he'll say, I have a pain inside. And I'll say, have you had a good bowel movement lately? I have no idea about pains inside. I mean, I know about pain, but it's about doing. A few weeks ago, three women, I got just enough sobriety to be obnoxious in my hometown. And there were about three women came to me, and they were saying, could you recommend a good woman sponsor? And I realized all these women had been sponsored by one woman. So I called this woman up. I said, you've been drunk? She said, no. I said, well, all your people are running around looking for new sponsors. I said, have you stopped using deodorant or anything? And she said, no. She said, I'm having a hard time. I have nothing to give. And I said, if you're having a hard time, you better find more people to sponsor. Where is it written that sponsorship is what we do when we have with what's left over? And where's that written? You're hurting. You hear what the big book says. Having trouble with sex? Work all the harder with others. Oh, you having financial trouble? Work all the harder with others. Oh, you having pain inside? Have a good bowel movement? Work all the harder with others. Now, where does this come from? I don't understand it. I said, listen, you. I said, have you checked this out with your sponsor? Yes, she agrees. I said, you find another sponsor. And then go make amends to these girls. And she did. And she called me about a week later. She said, I never thank you enough. My problem was I wasn't working with them enough. I said, what was the problem? She said, you know, a funny thing, I can't remember. And that's the way it is with problems. Let me tell you one more thing, and then I'll sit down and shut up. You know, I moved from Washington, D.C., where I got sober, to Fayetteville. I moved in 1980. I spent a couple years in Alabama, which is also a great sober place. But I came back to Fayetteville, and I came back for one reason, and that's because Fayetteville is my home. And I heard my sponsor, Tom I, say, first time I ever heard him talk, he said, I'm a resident of Aberdeen. He said, I vote there. He said, I've been on the school board. He said, I'm a citizen. He said, I attend church there. He said, my wife lives there, and my children grow up there. And I thought, what a novel concept to belong someplace. It never occurred to me that belonging was ever important. And I never belonged because I never felt as though I belonged. And I decided that Fayetteville was going to be my home, and it is. It's a wonderful place to live. And I vote. I vote on stuff I don't even understand. Every time they open those polls, I go and vote. Because you see, I'm a citizen of the greatest country in the world. And my home group meets on Monday night, and it's a new group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to be the program chairman, and they voted me out. And they got a new program chairman who they told me will do a much better job than I did. And I don't care. I'm just kidding. Now we have a 3-month tour, and I did mine because I'm. But now I'm, and I do it anyway, even when I was program chairman. But there are certain things I'm good at in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think we all have special talents. And I'm good at making coffee. I really am. I really am. I make the best coffee in the world. And I'm good at greeting people because I love to see people come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm good at getting people to come to our meeting. I go to the halfway houses and say, you know, your people won't be ignored at our meeting. At our meeting, they'll be greeted and they'll be important. And I'm good at that. And that's what I do. And we have a beginners group. And I'm good with the new folks. And I'm good at talking to them about stuff. I'm not good with old timers. I don't care a whole lot about old timers at all. Good thing about old timers is it doesn't matter. They won't be here long. Just kidding. And I belong there. I mean, I truly belong there. I got a library card. I never use it, but I got it, and it's mine, and it tells me that I belong there. And you know, when I moved there in 1980, I was in a little... Oh, and I have a lovely wife, Julia, and we live on a 10th green of the best golf course in town. You know, I mean, you talk about happiness. We have a little beach house. Not much. It's just a little cabin down on Carolina Beach in North Carolina. And if you're ever down that way, go down Carolina Avenue. You'll see a little sign. It says, CZ Does It. That's my beach house. And sometimes I go down there, and it's always being used by guys and girls in the program and stuff. And people retreat. The nuns at our parish use it for their retreat every year. And it's just sort of a God-filled place. It's a special place. And it's not the material stuff, though. That's just stuff that happens. But I was in this little apartment when I first moved there, and I was sober about 7 years at the time. And I was sitting there, and I was reading a big book, and a big book, and I was just overwhelmed with gratitude for you. And I said to my father, I said, "Why me, Father? Why have you picked me?" And I thought about when I was in that treatment center, and I called this woman I'd been married to and had tormented so, and I said to her, I said, "I'm an alcoholic." She said, "No kidding." And I said, "Why me?" She said, "Why not? If anybody deserves it, you do." She hung up. So here I am in this street, in this little apartment overlooking the lake. And I said, "Why me, Father?" And he said, "Why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do." And I know that to be true. I don't deserve it because of anything I did. I deserve it because of what he did. And I deserve it because of you. And I deserve it because I'm the son of a king, for crying out loud. I'm not a dirt ball. I never was. I just went away for a while. When my little angel Kelly was in the playground, she was about 3 years old. I used to love to watch her. Yeah, I love to watch little kids. They seem to make so much more sense than the rest of us. And I was sitting there watching her. And you know how little kids, they'll start away and they always look back to make sure you're there. And they always check in with you, and they look back. And she was over there, and some bully bumped into her and knocked her down, you know. And she got up, and she looked in the wrong direction. And she didn't see me, so she began to cry, and she began to run in circles. She began to scream, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." And I was hollering to her, but she couldn't hear me because she was shouting so loud. And finally she stopped, and she looked at me, and she ran across the playground, and she threw herself into my lap, and she just sobbed. You know how little kids can sob even from their toenails, you know, just sobbed. And she said, "Daddy, I thought you were gone." I said, "I'll never be gone, sweetheart." She said, "I thought you left." And I said, "I'll never leave you." I said, "I love you, and I'll never leave you." And she said, "But you weren't there." And I said, "Well," I said, "you were running around screaming so loud that you couldn't hear me." And she said, "Okay." She got down and she went off and played. And you know, that's the way it is with my father. You know, there was a time when a bully named Alcoholism knocked me off my feet, and I got up and I was looking in the wrong direction, and I ran around and I screamed and I did all sorts of things. And I was screaming so loud and I was demanding so loud and I was denying so hard that I couldn't see him. And then one day I shut up. And he said, and I saw him, and I ran over and I jumped up into his lap, and he held me and he rocked me. And he held me close to his heart. And I said, "I thought you left me." And he said, "I'll never leave you." He said, "You were shouting so loud and you were making so many demands that you couldn't hear me." And I said, "Okay." And I got down, now I just run around. Yeah. A couple times a day I go over and crawl up in his lap, check it out. Sometimes I just look over and nod, wave, and he nods and waves. And that's the way it works for me. It's really very, very simple. It has to do with coming to these meetings. It has to do with listening to the voice of God. It has to do with good sponsorship. It has to do with step work. It has to do with not entering into controversy with one another. has to do with seeking God's will on all levels in our group and in our individual lives, in our marriages and with our children. It just has to do with being a child of God. And the good news is, that's what we were born for. Thank you.